especially on a day like this. So I'm going to talk about a new way to probe primordial magnetic fields. Okay, so why should you care about primordial magnetic fields or magnetic fields in the universe at all? Well, our universe is magnetized. We observe magnetic fields on practically all observable scales, from stars to galaxies and galaxy clusters. However, the origin of these magnetic fields, cosmic magnetic fields, is as of yet an unresolved question in astrophysics. And the standard paradigm is that the current day magnetic fields and large-scale magnetic fields came about by amplification of some sort of seed fields. And these seed fields could have come from primordial times, from inflation, or they, there are also theories proposing mechanisms that involve structure formation at later times as well. But needless to say, if we were somehow able to detect very small scale, say large coherence lengths, magnetic fields at high redshift, and somehow be certain these are actually primordial in origin, then this would be another observational avenue for probing, the physics of the early universe. However, the problem is that typical predictions for the strength of primordial magnetic fields from inflationary mechanisms are, for example, on the order of 10 to minus 30 Gauss. So these are tiny numbers. There are other various post-inflationary mechanisms that they claim to be able to get up to, say, 10 to minus 15 Gauss or so. But the bottom line here is that typically we'd be looking for a very, very small strength magnetic fields. And then another problem when invoking present-day observations is that if you were to make a claim that you're indeed observing primordial fields, you would need to make sure that the various astrophysical mechanisms that act at late times have not polluted your signal. Now, very briefly, some of the current constraints are listed here. Perhaps not all of them are the most up-to-date, but they capture the order of magnitude. So they come from CMB spectral distortions, like Yassine mentioned this morning, from CMB anisotropies, and other probes of matter power spectrum, like the large-scale structure and so on. And all of these limits that I listed here, with the exception of the last one, are upper bounds. The one on the bottom was a claim that there was a lower limit in the on the magnetic fields in voids that could be primordial in nature from Fermi observations, Fermi blazar observations. However, this claim that places a lower limit on 10 to minus 15 Gauss. However, this claim has been disputed by various people, amongst others, Avery Broderick here at Perimeter and others. But all of these confirmed upper limits are in the range of nanogauss at present time. These upper limits from the CMB, for example, will improve by maybe a few orders of magnitude with the next generation experiments. So bottom line here, what I want you to take away from this slide is that these current upper limits are still far beyond where we expect the signal to be. Now, this talk is not going to be about the physics of primordial magnetic fields or modeling primordial magnetic fields. I want to talk about the possibility of detecting them. And in particular, I'm going to focus on a series of two papers that I put up with my collaborators, last one of which was just a couple of months ago. And these papers were all about a new method that proposes to use 21-centimeter tomography to probe minuscule strength, large-scale magnetic fields directly in situ in the high redshift AGM. And the point at which we got interested in thinking about this effect some more that I'll talk about in more detail is that order of magnitude calculation, which I'll show you in a few slides, implies that with this method we could reach down below magnetic fields of strength on the order of 10 to minus 21 Gauss in commoving units. So approaching the regime where we might expect the the signal for these seed fields to be. These folks all greatly contributed to this work. Tejam Enumadov at the IAS was a lead on the first of these two papers in this series. And the paper discussed the microphysics of the effect of magnetic fields on 21 centimeter fluctuations. I led the second paper, which developed formalism to actually search for the effect of magnetic fields in future 21 centimeter tomography data. And the other folks from OSU and Caltech were there as well. So the rest of this talk will be outlined as follows. So I'll very briefly give you a two-minute introduction to 21 centimeter tomography, just to put everyone on the same page in case you haven't been thinking about it lately. Then I'll go over very quick heuristic description of the hyperfine structure of hydrogen and the effect of magnetic fields on it. And then I'll present the main results from the first paper that discusses the microphysics of this effect. After that, I'll move on to a little bit more technical discussion of the formalism that might enable us to search for these signatures in future data. And at the end, I'll show you some numerical results, some sensitivity forecasts for future tomography surveys. Okay, so, excuse me, the main idea of 21 centimeter tomography is that neutral hydrogen, ground state of neutral hydrogen has hyperfine structure. The excited state, the triplet, and the true ground state, the singlet, are split by an energy gap that corresponds to the emission of a photon at 21 centimeter wavelength in the rest frame of the atoms. It's a forbidden transition, so the lifetime in the excited state is very long. And the idea of 21 centimeter tomography is that basically during and prior to the epoch of reionization, the universe was full of neutral hydrogen. So there's a hope that if we look for redshifted 21 centimeter emission from this neutral hydrogen at high redshift, we can map out essentially the density fluctuations at redshifts beyond 6 and going up to into the dark ages before the first sources of light turned on, as this simulation is depicting. And then going, scanning in the frequency direction would be equivalent to scanning through different redshifts. So the idea is, in a sense, to basically eventually make a sort of a map of the sky at every redshift in the density or the brightness temperature fluctuations and therefore density fluctuations. Now, this goal has not been achieved yet. We have not made a detection. The era of 21 centimeter cosmology have not yet started. However, there's a number, there's a large experimental effort worldwide going after the signal from reionization and trying, to take first steps towards 21 centimeter tomography, only some of which I've shown here. I apologize if you have other favorite ones. But for example, there's the paper experiment that has two sites, one in Green Bank, one in South Africa. Then there's MWA in Australia. Those are both sort of pathfinders for a larger effort called the Hydrogen Epoch of Reionization, or HERA. And there are many others. Okay, so very, toy picture. This is how the hyperfine structure of hydrogen atom looks like in the presence of the magnetic fields. The degeneracy in the triplet state is broken. And the take-home point from this plot is that the triplet state has a net magnetic moment. So the effect of an external magnetic field of atoms in the excited state of this transition will be precession of the atoms around the direction of the magnetic field. Now, the second point I want you also to take is that, again, in this toy picture, if you imagine an atom sitting in the singlet state absorbing a photon depicted with these magnetic and electric field vector lines, its magnetic moment will get excited in direction parallel to B. And then when it decays back to the ground state, it'll preferentially emit in the equatorial plane, so in the directions perpendicular to this direction of mu. So in other words, there is sort of a memory, it's a quadrupolar emission pattern, there's a memory of what the incident radiation, of the direction of the incident radiation. So now if you imagine an ensemble of atoms in an isotropic bath of 21 centimeter radiation, they'll excite their magnetic moments in random directions. However, if you give them a little more radiation from the sides and from top and bottom, so you put them in a quadrupolar anisotropy, then they'll tend to align along the direction connecting the cold spots. So there will be some amount of polarization, so-called polarization of the ground state of hydrogen. And this is exactly the condition that we have in the early universe at high redshift, where the quadrupolar anisotropy just comes from the velocity fields. It's driven from by the density fluctuations, which I'm depicting here with the shading of the background. So again, heuristic picture, imagine an ensemble of atoms sitting on a crust of a density wave. They'll see a little bit less Hubble expansion in direction perpendicular to the crest of the wave, and a little more in the perpendicular, in the directional along the crest. And so there'll be, just because of the density fluctuations, there will be quadrupolar anisotropy in the surrounding 21 centimeter emission. So there'll be some degree of the spin alignment in an inhomogeneous universe. And you can imagine we can track this amount of alignment in a statistical sense because we know that the statistical description of the density perturbations. Now, so far I haven't mentioned the magnetic field yet. If I now turn on an external magnetic field, which is coherent on scales larger than the scale of the relevant density perturbation here, say the field coming out of the plane of the drawing here, then the atoms will start precessing around the direction of B. If they now decay back to ground state, so remember this is a delimit quadrupolar emission pattern. So in the case where you have no magnetic field, this rescattered quadrupole that they emit decaying back to ground state will be aligned with the incident quadrupole. However, in this case, it'll be slightly misaligned depending on how much the atoms have precessed in the lifetime of this excited state. Now, now let me do the back of the envelope that I promised you to do. So let's say that we're talking about redshifts of 20. At those redshifts, the lifetime of the excited state, or more precisely, the depolarization time of the triplet state is something on the order of 30,000 years. The lifetime of the triplet state to radiative decay is much larger than that, but this takes into account other effects like stimulated emission and atomic collisions and so on. So it's an extremely long baseline. And then you can time baseline over which these atoms sort of sit polarized, the ground state sits polarized. And now you can write down the standard expression for the Larmor, for the frequency of Larmor precession. You just have to plug in fundamental constants to describe the electron on the left, on the right-hand side. And if you now ask a question of how strong a magnetic field do you need in order to produce order one mismatch in the direction of the incident quadrupole, which we can trace through the statistics of density fluctuations, and this rescattered quadrupole that the atoms emit when they decay back to the ground state. So you want to produce order one changes, so say that the angle theta, you want it to be on the order of a radian. Then plugging in on the right-hand side of the last equation, is there, oh, excellent. Okay, great. So plugging in to this equation the time scale of depolarization and the Larmor frequency, you can come up with a magnetic field that's on the order of 10 to the minus 19 Gauss in physical units. So what this means is that That weak a field, or weaker, can produce order one changes in this rescattered emission quadruple. So this is the number that I quoted at the very beginning. It doesn't assume anything about how sensitive your experiment needs to be in order to trace this second order rescattered quadruple. It just tells us that if we are able to track this secondary emission, then we're able to automatically access these strengths of the magnetic fields at higher redshift. Okay. Now, without going into any technical detail, the first paper, part one of the study, was to work out the microphysics of this effect. And while the standard calculation, standard 21 centimeter calculation, typically needs to only keep track of the populations, of the relative populations of the singlet state and the total population of all the sublevels in the triplet state to obtain the spin temperature defined in this way, if you have the spin temperature, then you can figure out what your signal should look like against the background CMB. However, in this case, to describe the precession, the atomic precession, we needed to keep track of the entire atomic density matrix, and then also to figure out the coupled evolution of the radiation, 21 centimeter radiation phase space density matrix and the atomic density matrix. And the net, the key result of this study was this analytic formula for the brightness temperature fluctuation, or the brightness temperature fluctuation emission pattern that includes all the usual ingredients that every standard 21 centimeter brightness temperature calculation does, which means radiated transitions, atomic collisions, Lyman alpha pumping in with Heisen field effect, but then it also includes the effects of the magnetic field. So this first term here is the standard stuff, I'm sorry. And then the second term is a second order correction, where that last chunk here is the portion that depends on the magnetic field. So let me just give you a very quick rundown of the what different symbols here mean. So here's the spin temperature and the CMB temperature, the neutral fraction, delta up there, which I really wish I could point to, is the density fluctuation that drives the fluctuations in the brightness temperature. And then these coefficients, axis down here, all quantify the rates of depolarization of ground state due to Lyman alpha emission, due to atomic collisions, and then the rate of precession around direction of the magnetic field. So this XB is proportional to the strength of the magnetic field, and that's a factor that captures the effect of the magnetic field. All right, so now this equation basically gives me everything I need to compute the signal, the 21 centimeter signal in presence of magnetic fields in any given direction, in the rest frame of the atoms, any given direction, line of sight N, for any given mode K. So if I wanted to evaluate this expression, I would need to know the spin temperature, the IGM, kinetic temperature, the Lyman alpha flux evolutions, all as a function of redshift, and those ingredients can be obtained from codes like 21 centimeter fast. At the end, now I also just wanted to mention, I just also wanted to define one more quantity, which is this transfer function G. On the left-hand side, is there any other laser pointer by some chance? Or is this? That's okay. That's a problem with being the last speaker of the day. You guys use laser pointer a lot. Okay, so this transfer function G, which gives me a connection between the brightness temperature signal and the density fluctuation, I can also compute given this expression for the temperature. And so given, oh, thank you, wonderful. Thanks, awesome. And so I can, given the statistic of the density perturbations, in other words, the matter power spectrum, which I can get from codes like CAMP, I can compute the statistic, the two-point correlation function for the brightness temperature fluctuations as well, which will be the key in this work. Okay, now evaluating the previous equation, the emission pattern, the anisotropic part of it looks like this. So here I've put a magnetic field in the vertical direction. The K vector comes out of the hot spots up on the top figure. So this is just one configuration for illustration. And so from going from the top plot downwards, I've cranked up the magnetic field. So what you can see is that this quadrupolar pattern that you have in the case of no magnetic field sort of slowly morphs into a different quadrupolar pattern when the magnetic field reaches the saturation limit. In other words, where the magnetic field is strong enough that the atoms precess many times before they came back to the ground state. In the saturation limit, and this will be important for later, you can still distinguish this pattern from the null case. However, in the saturation limit, you can no longer recover the strength of the magnetic field from your signal. So you can put a lower limit. All right, moving on to the second part of this study, where we worked out the estimator formalism that can be applied to future tomographic 21-centimeter data. This is a part of the story that might be very familiar to folks who do CME statistic and you know, lensing estimators and stuff like that. So in case you're not interested in technical detail, in words, the summary of the two next slides is this. The two next slides will be technical, but the summary is this, that homogeneous magnetic fields, magnetic field which is homogeneous in the entire survey volume, it's a limiting case, will introduce a preferred direction in the signal. It'll introduce anisotropy. A stochastic magnetic field will produce off-diagonal cross-correlations between different Fourier modes, which is not there in the null case in the isotropic Gaussian universe. So it'll produce statistical anisotropy. Now, in a bit more technical detail, this is what happens. So say that for the rest of this talk, I will assume that the magnetic field evolves adiabatically as a function of redshift. So it goes just as z squared. And this B naught will be the strength of the field in comoving units. And that's the quantity I would like to reconstruct. I'm not assuming for the moment that the magnetic field is homogeneous. It can have spatial fluctuations. So that's my unknown that I want to recover, perhaps as a function of scale. My observable is the brightness temperature fluctuation T as a function of the position in the sky. And that measurement will have contributions from both the signal, the cosmological signal that's there in the null case when there's no magnetic field, and the contribution from the magnetic field. And that's the portion that I can compute given the results from the first study that I showed you before. And then there's also the contribution from the noise, both the instrumental noise and from galactic foregrounds, which are overwhelming in a strong signal. So as I said, I have all the tools at this point to compute the null signal and the contribution of the magnetic field, where again, for the rest of this talk, I will assume linear theory. I will assume that the magnetic field produces a small correction to this brightness temperature fluctuation. Going to Fourier space and applying convolution theorem, I get the equation on the bottom. Again, what I want you to notice here is that in the null case, you will have this first term. In the case where there is a magnetic field, you will have this term that basically makes the mode K in temperature dependent on other temperature modes. It produces this cross correlation between modes. So in principle, if I could measure this and I know the theory, then I can invert this equation and recover what this B is. However, of course, we don't have predictions for what the temperature fluctuations should look like in any given particular direction in the sky, but what we do have is a statistical description of the 21 centimeter fluctuations. So what I can write down is a two-point correlation function in temperature. And in this case, considering not only the power spectrum, but off-diagonal correlations as well, and essentially looking for excess correlation that might be in the data. So in the null case, where there's no magnetic field, notice that there's this Dirac delta function, there's no off-diagonal correlation between the modes. In the case where there is a magnetic field, I get this second term, which I now have the tools to evaluate for any given cosmology, any given strength of the magnetic field. Now, if I literally invert this equation to express B, B of K, where this capital K is just satisfies this condition, I can evaluate the strength of the magnetic field, any given mode of the magnetic field, from every KK prime pair of modes measured in the temperature field. So this is the estimator for B of K from a given KK prime pair. And I have many such pairs that I can reconstruct from any given tomographic map. So combining all the estimates, summing over all KK prime pairs, and weighing down those modes that are most contaminated from the cosmological signal or the noise, I will arrive at the optimal quadratic estimator, minimum variance quadratic estimator for the magnetic field B of K. At this point, I have not assumed anything about the specific model of the magnetic field. All that I assumed is that the magnetic field is weak, and that it's coherent, the coherence length, so the I'm only considering modes that are larger than the density fluctuations, than the scale of density fluctuations or temperature fluctuations that I'm using for this reconstruction. So this is a model-independent procedure. So without really writing down this minimum variance estimator, I will just say that its variance constitutes this noise power spectrum. So the variance of the full estimator looks like that, where I have this integral over case. And then if I wanted to ask a question of how sensitive will a given experiment be to recovering magnetic field at any given mode of the magnetic field at higher redshifts, I can assume a signal, so for any particular model of the magnetic field, and use this to evaluate my signal to noise. And so next, I want to show you the results for such an exercise. All right, so for doing sensitivity forecasts, we've considered two models, so two cases. One is a limiting case where the field is uniform in the entire survey volume. And the other one, just as an example, not particularly motivated from any theory of interest, just as an example of a stochastic field case, we've considered a field with a scale-independent power spectrum. Another couple of ingredients, some of which I mentioned previously, is we had to assume some reionization history, some evolution of the spin temperature, which I'm showing here, some evolution of the Lyman alpha flux. And then we also folded in the noise from galactic foregrounds, assuming that the sky temperature goes as 1 plus E to a pretty high power, 2.55. So we folded in Gaussian homogeneous contribution of the foregrounds to the noise. For an experiment, for a tomographic experiment, we assumed an array of dipole antennas in a compact grid configuration. And the reason we only this is a configuration that some of the experiments that I mentioned at the beginning will have. Not all of the 21 centimeter experiments will follow that pattern, but that is a configuration that gives you most redundancy, most sampling per mode in the sky. So it's known to maximize sensitivity to recovering, for example, the power spectrum of 21, the cosmological signal power spectrum from 21 centimeter fluctuations. So we focused on that configuration. We've also assumed that redshifts between 15 and 25 are accessible to us, that the field of view of these antennas is on the order of 1 steradian, and an integration time of about 3 years. So just to place this in context, for those of you who may not be familiar where these experiments are right now, so this wouldn't be the sizes of the arrays and the precision that we need wouldn't be the very first generation of experiments. They would be maybe second or third generation experiments. Okay, so let me just show you now some results. So here, what I'm showing is on the horizontal axis is the maximum array baseline in kilometers. So if you want to know what the coverage area, you know, what the area of the surface of the Earth covered in dipole antennas densely packed next to each other is, you should square this number. Okay. So notice that I'm starting from a kilometer square array. This is perhaps something like, you know, third stage of Hare or something like that. So this would not be the very first generation of experiments that will make the very first detection of the cosmological 21 centimeter signal. On the horizontal axis, on the vertical axis is the one sigma threshold for detecting a magnetic field in Gauss comoving. So those are the numbers that you should compare to the quoted numbers from other reported upper limits and projections. So we'll consider two cases here. As I said, the bottom dark red line is for a field that's uniform in the entire survey volume. That's the more optimistic case, easiest to recover. And then the gray line corresponds to a stochastic field with the scaling invariant power spectrum. Again, those are the parameters that I mentioned in the previous slide. So the take-home point here is that a square kilometer array can reach a one sigma threshold for detecting magnetic fields that are on the order of the saturation limit that I was mentioning of 10 to the minus 21 Gauss comoving. Now, what happens if the field is in the saturation limit? So once you can evaluate this noise levels for, you might ask a question of, couldn't I just go to maybe smaller scale experiments, more, less futuristic, and just, have this number be a little, maybe a little higher? And the answer to that is that you have to be below the saturation limit to actually measure the strength of the magnetic field. So when I got this result, I had to go back into the code and check that the contribution to the signal to noise from redshifts that I have most signal to noise is actually that the sensitivity is below the saturation regime where my result is actually valid. So here I'm showing you the contribution to this one sigma limit as a function of redshift. So stepping through redshift bins, and the lower this curve is, the more sensitive you are. This is the top curve is for one square kilometer array, and then going through a few other sizes. But the bottom line here is that most sensitivity is where the curves, most sensitivity comes from the redshifts where the curves have their minima. And this gray dashed line is a very rough conservative calculation where the saturation limit is at that redshift. So when the curves are below the saturation limit, that's where you should trust these numbers. Okay, so for a uniform field, you can see that basically the sensitivity curves basically graze this saturation limit. And so this quote for a square kilometer array reaching, roughly a sigma, one sigma sensitivity are fairly safe. However, if you want to claim a detection, you probably want to go down to more futuristic arrays in the order of 10 kilometers squared or something like that. Okay, now what happens, I mentioned that, the saturation, going back to this picture, the saturation pattern, the pattern that you reach when you're in the saturation, well in the saturation regime, is still different from the null case, but you can't recover the strength of a magnetic field. But you still can ask a question at that point, what is the sensitivity of a given array to claiming a lower limit that corresponds to the saturation limit at a given redshift from its measurement? And that's answered in this result. So if you focus for a second on the formula here on the bottom, so this signal power spectrum, I can model as a sum of contribution of no magnetic field plus a contribution from large magnetic field, where the relative contributions are parameterized by this parameter xi. So xi of 0, corresponding to the bottom of the figure here, means no magnetic field. Xi of 1, this is bounded between 0 and 1. Xi of 1 means magnetic field in the saturation regime. So you can ask a question of with what confidence could an experiment exclude, for example, xi of 0? In favor, xi of 1, meaning favor a magnetic field that corresponds to the saturation limit. And again, this sensitivity curve corresponds to answer that question, for a field that's uniform in the entire survey volume, again, as a function of the maximum array baseline. So one sigma distinction you can barely reach with a one square kilometer array. All right, so in summary, what I showed you here, I think I'm 10 minutes early. Okay, what I showed you here is a promising new method to trace possibly primordial magnetic fields, a method that has, you know, all the desirable properties that would help us reach that goal, in that it's particularly optimized for tracing large-scale magnetic fields in situ at high redshift, and magnetic fields that are very weak, many orders of magnitude, in fact, 10 orders of magnitude weaker than the reported current constraints. So as soon as, you know, the whatever second or third generation of these tomographic experiments reaches enough sensitivity to be able to trace the second order correction in the two-point function of the 21 centimeter brightness temperature fluctuations, that'll basically immediately open up a possibility to measuring magnetic fields that are on that order 10 to minus 21 Gauss at high redshifts. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Vera. Any questions?
And a quadrupole anisotropy, so that's like the local CMB basically that they're seeing. That's a 21 centimeter that's local. Or what is a quadrupole?
Sorry, say again?
You have a density fluctuation and it's interacting with the quadrupole that the atoms are seeing around them in the 21 centimeter radiation, but that's basically the CMB around them, right? That's what you mean? Or?
No, so this is the emission of the surrounding atoms. So we're talking about two scattering process, okay, which you don't normally consider. So the atoms around you emit 21 centimeter photons, you absorb them, get excited in the triplet state, and then decay back, and so that's scattered.
Sorry. So even though it's only like 1% or something, optical depth.
Right, so it's
that's low.
That's why, exactly, that's okay. Why it's a small signal, yeah.
Oh, okay, so it's that rescattered, okay.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Right, so it's not small because the magnetic field, it's not small because the magnetic field is small, it's small to start with the second order in tau. I'm sorry?
Yes, why do you not to consider just the fluctuation Earth magnetic field? For example, is that the Schumann resonance? Is that the low frequency magnetic field is fluctuating every time? That's the, this kind of effect can be involved in this formula?
Sorry, I didn't quite understand you. Why not consider the fluctuation in the spatial fluctuation in the magnetic field? Is that what you mean?
That's the on time. It's from now, here is also the fluctuation of the magnetic field. That is why from this Earth itself is a fluctuation of the magnetic field itself. Then it's your consideration seems to be not to ignore such kind of effect.
So sorry, I have a hard time.
She just measured, they're using measurements of the polarization.
Yeah. But
the polarization is not affected by the local magnetic field. It's only affected by the physics sense.
Ah, I see.
Very high redshift, when the photons are scattered at proximals. So they're just measuring photons here, right?
Yeah, sorry, but I didn't, can you explain?
No, he was saying,
oh, right. No. So this is why I said in situ probe. Right. This is the effect at high redshift. That's right. Thank you, Neil.
Anybody else? You go for it.
Sorry, I may have missed this. Did you say for the array of dipoles that you're going to correlate each pair of dipoles?
Yeah.
Okay. Have you worked out how many flops that takes?
How many what?
Flops that takes.
No. That's for you to work on.
I just did a quick calculation. 10 zettaflops, so be prepared.
Great.
Yeah, it's a new prefix for me.
You mean because it's high redshifts? Is that, sorry, what? Oh, because it's a lot of compute, yeah. No. No.
Okay, if that's it, then that's it for the day. See you guys all tomorrow. Let's thank Vera one more time.